Champaign-Danville overhead doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville overhead doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Open the door to great prizes for your home. The WILL Sweepstakes is here. Enter today and you could win the grand prize, a flat-screen high-definition television set from Glenpoor's Audio Video of Champaign and a family theater sofa from Carter's Furniture. Or one of 10 other fabulous prizes, a Dell computer, handcrafted shaker-style furniture, a Fender electric guitar, and more. Watch your mail for the sweepstakes packet and enter soon. To request an entry form, call 217-333-1070.
It's 107. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. And this is an archive edition of the Afternoon Magazine interview segment, so please no phone calls this afternoon.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. In 1915, men's wristwatches were a novelty. Many people thought they were just a fad. They'd never replace the pocket watch. While the watch was an innovation, not a fad, there have been plenty of things and ideas that have fallen flat after a brief flash of enthusiasm. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the phenomenon of the fad, in particular the institutional fad, fads in business, medicine, science, and education. Our guest is sociologist Joel Best, author of Flavor of the Month, Why Smart People Fall for Fads. Joel Best is professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. He's the author of several books, including Damned Lies and Statistics, Untangling Numbers from the Media, Politicians, and Activists, and More Damned Lies and Statistics, How Numbers Confuse Public Issues. Those books, as well as his latest, Flavor of the Month, Why Smart People Fall for Fads, are all published by the University of California Press. Professor Best, welcome back to the program.
Yes, thanks, Celeste.
My pleasure to have you back again. So tell us a little bit about the wristwatch. Why was it seen as a fad? That was a fun story to read.
Yeah, it is. The great fear was among jewelers, and they sensed that the wristwatch was cheaper than the pocket watches that they were used to selling. Yeah, and they worried that this newfangled, inexpensive item would replace the pocket watch, and they insisted that it would not. They said this is just a fad; it can't possibly last. And of course, it had a pretty good run. I read a story last week that said that young people now are abandoning wristwatches because they have cell phones and they don't see any reason to carry a wristwatch too.
Huh.
But it had about a 90-year run.
Oh, why? Well, I've got mine on.
Well, so do I.
Yeah. You know, when we hear the word fad, I suspect we most often think of clothing or toys, gadgets. But our institutions and serious professionals get caught up in fads, too. You want to share an example or two?
Well, there are lots of them. It's easiest to share the ones from the past. If we go back to the 1980s, you look at American industry, and there was a great fear that the Japanese were going to overtake the American economy, and we needed to copy whatever the Japanese were doing. And so you had hundreds of major American corporations announce that they were going to adopt quality circles, which was a Japanese practice of bringing managers and workers together to discuss how to improve quality. That's gone. In the early 1980s, psychiatrists began to diagnose hundreds of people, actually thousands of people, as having multiple personality disorder, which was an old diagnosis, but it was almost never used. And all of a sudden, there was a great wave of these diagnoses in the 1980s. In 1989, people remember when the two scientists at the University of Utah announced that they discovered cold fusion. Now, that didn't last very long. Within about 2 months, it had been thoroughly debunked by other laboratories around the world. But there was a brief period of excitement when people were speculating what a world with very inexpensive energy would be like. And it's easy to look back on the 80s and see that. Now, you might say, well, were the 80s a fad-infested decade? And I don't think they were. But if you talk about something that's happening today, people will deny it's a fad. So that you might look, for example, at the tremendous enthusiasm for using standardized tests to measure school performance, the No Child Left Behind Act and so on. And, you can suspect that 15 years from now, when we look back on this period, we'll say, boy, we went overboard on standardized testing. But right now, the people who believe in this innovation, who are promoting it, insist, oh, no, this is the real deal. And it's always possible, I think, for people at the beginning of a fad to claim this is no fad. In fact, they'll reject using the F word.
Yeah. Now, why are we likely to associate fads with something trivial then?
Well, I think partly that's just the way we use the word. We tend to talk about it as silly things that young people do. So we have toy fads and dance fads and telephone booth stuffing on college campuses and things like that. People resist the idea that there are fads within serious institutions because the very term fad doesn't seem serious. But anyone who has watched business or education or even medicine science can identify enthusiasms that have passed through those institutions. When you go to schools in different eras and you're told that we have a completely new way to teach reading or a completely new way to teach arithmetic, when you are at a business and the corporation leaders come in and say, we've decided to implement this entirely new management strategy, and so on and so forth. And, of course, everyone is saying this is completely serious, it's real, it is no fad. But, sure enough, a few years down the road, we will have forgotten about it.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if, because we so often associate the word fad with something trivial, that we're more susceptible to institutional fads.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. Social scientists talk about the process of diffusion. And if you look at any new thing that comes along, television, initially nobody has a TV set, and then just a few people get it, and then you get a very sharp increase in TV sets until you level off at some level where everybody who's going to get a TV set has one, and that's called diffusion. And fads look a lot like that at the start. Nobody has a hula hoop, lots of people get them, you reach a peak, and then it drops off. So during that first period when it's spreading, it's possible to believe that you are dealing with a real innovation. And I call this the illusion of diffusion. And I think that people, buy into this and insist upon it in the early stages of development. And they're often wrong. And sometimes they can be wrong in two ways. They can be wrong like they were with the wristwatch, where they say, well, this is just a fad, and it proves to be a lasting case of diffusion. But they're also often wrong when they say, well, this is the way we're going to be doing things from now on. You know, the 8-track tape, CB radio, and so on.
Yeah. Seemed like a good idea at the time.
That's right.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Sociologist Joel Best is our guest this afternoon. We're talking today about fads. His latest book is Flavor of the Month, Why Smart People Fall for Fads. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk with our guest. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have two things I think are fads. One's in your backyard. And if they're not fads, perhaps you can, distinguish them from fads and why they aren't. In the early 60s, when I was an undergraduate, I took sociology as a minor, and at that time, small group studies were
Absolutely. Couldn't
go down a hallway in the sociology department without some guy running out and grabbing you and coming in here. I got three other people. I want you to sit down and ask you some questions. I actually got paid for doing this at times, but I thought, you know, I never thought of it as being a fad, but it certainly fits the property of everybody's doing it. And another thing that I ran across later on, everybody was doing it. I was working in a laboratory for a company, and all of a sudden I got swooped up into, you're going to go to a motel and be locked up for 3 days, and you'll be given pamphlets, and you'll be given a question, and you and your other people have to come to a decision before you get out of there Monday morning. And I remember it had an acronym, but I don't remember what it was. And all of a sudden, you know, I found out in the town I am has a lot of factories at one time. At that time, it did, and everybody was doing it. I found out everybody in the corporation was going through this, so it wasn't like you could get out of it. You know, hey, I'm putting up with this. You're going to put up with it. And I asked my boss what was going on, and he says, "Well, somebody in corporate found out that somebody in another corporation used this plan, and all of a sudden they got, like, you know, I can't remember the number, but it was minuscule, like 7% increase in production from the salaried people." And I thought, okay, fine, you know, so we went through it and everything, but it got to the place where people were going to beat up on each other, and I thought, this is the strangest thing I've ever been in. You know, in that respect, it had something to do with people who are educated and, you know, are making money. And I just wonder if you could comment on those two things, and if those are just anecdotal things that don't mean anything, or whether or not this thing, you know, pops around in various places all the time, and sometimes we're in it and we just don't know we're in it. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are both good examples, and I think that's exactly right. When you're doing it, you may suspect that it's just a fad. If you express that, you may be criticized for not getting with the program and not having sufficient vision and so on. The small group example is one that is absolutely right. There was a period when that was a very important specialty within sociology, and it's fallen by the wayside. And in fact, I think that you can look at absolutely any intellectual activity, any academic discipline, any science, in fact, and you will see that research topics come into fashion, and everybody's very excited about them for a while, and then they seem to run out of gas. And I've written about this, and lots of people have written about it. People talk about academic fads all the time, and I think you're absolutely right. Small groups is certainly one of them. And I don't know which particular brand of management packaging that was that you were involved in, but clearly the same thing passes through business. And I think that what is really important in that example that you gave is that very often these things spread on the basis of a good story, an anecdote. That is, there's very little evidence. In the mid-1990s, the country got completely caught up in the idea that educational problems could be solved if only public schools would require students to wear uniforms. And you know, I remember President Clinton was talking about this. Everybody was talking about it. And it was one of those ideas that appealed to both conservatives and liberals. Conservatives liked it because it was going to bring kind of discipline and order to the classroom. And liberals liked it because it was going to make the classroom seem more equitable, you know, the various, you know, status symbols that students of different classes could wear wouldn't be available. And all of this enthusiasm was based on a story that a school in California had required uniforms and everything had worked out for them. And there were all of these extraordinary claims that uniforms were going to end discipline problems and increase learning and end absenteeism and all this kind of stuff. And, of course, when the research eventually came out years later, it didn't show any of that. But at the time, you get this story that somebody had good results with this, and that produces a fad.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone on line 1. Hi.
Hey, yeah, I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between your fads and memetics and epidemiology of ideas. And I'll hang up and listen now. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what that was asking. I think that certainly medicine goes through fads. That is, you have fad diagnoses and fad treatments and so on. And usually, if they don't work, they get bounced out fairly quickly. But you have periods when everybody is very excited about this promising treatment or this new diagnosis or whatever. And I think that while we don't like to think of medicine or science as being particularly fad-ridden, they both have a fair amount of fads passing through them.
Yeah, we often see fads in diet.
Oh, yeah.
And that could certainly be seen as something that would affect health.
Well, yeah, a lot of this is I talk about it mostly in terms of people in organizations. You know, the boss comes to you and says, you've got to do this. But notice that we get a lot of information from experts about what is it safe to eat, what is it, how can we best lose weight, how should we raise our kids. And there are certainly fads in all of those things that come through. And I think actually the caller may have been, he talked about epidemiology, and what he may be talking about is every Wednesday, the Journal of the American Medical Association releases press releases on that week's new articles. And, you know, a lot of people follow these things, and they tell you that, having a drink a day is actually good for you, and then 2 weeks later there's a story that says having a drink a day will kill you. And there's a tremendous amount of research of that sort where people that try and guide their diet and so on by the medical results of the week often wind up confused.
Yeah. Is there an upside to fads, though? After all, aren't we searching really for a better mousetrap?
Oh, sure. And part of this taps right into American culture. We believe in progress. Anybody who's been alive for 5 years has seen progress. We're all familiar with the phenomenon of progress, and we're confident that it's real, and that's a strength in our culture. If you look around the world at societies where tradition or ritual or stability are more valued, they tend to have problems that we don't have. So we want to have progress, and fads are based on the idea that there's a problem, and we can solve it. And there are always problems. If you're in business, you could always make more money. If you're in education, your students could always be learning more. If you're a doctor, you could always make more people well. And so all of this is an attempt to solve problems, and a lot of it oversells how effective this is going to be. It promises wonder-working changes that don't actually take place. But the basic idea is not a bad one.
Yeah. Now, you write about this in Flavor of the Month, the gap. We want to close that gap between where we are now and smarter kids and more profit. And so that gap, though, can lead us into some trouble. It's a two-edged sword, you say.
That's right. And, I think that when we declare war on poverty or we announce that we're going to leave no child behind, we're establishing a kind of perfectionist standard for what works. And pretty much inevitably, there are going to be some kids that don't learn to read well. And that will provide an occasion for beating ourselves up for what we're not doing right, the schools are failing, and so on and so forth, and it leads to faddish behavior. If I can take just a minute, there's an example that really fascinates me, and it's a boring example, and that's why it's so interesting. It's traffic fatalities. If you go back to 1966, we were killing more than 50,000 people a year on the highways. Today, it's closer to 40,000. And during that period, during those 40 years, the number of drivers has doubled. The number of miles we drive has tripled. So that if you take deaths per 100 million miles driven, they've dropped by three quarters. If we were killing people at the rate that we used to kill them 40 years ago, we'd have about 170 traffic fatalities a year. And how did we make this amazing progress? It really is a story of fabulous progress. We didn't do it by declaring war on traffic fatalities. We did it by nibbling at the problem. We designed better cars in lots of little ways. You know, first front seat belts and back seat belts and shoulder harnesses and airbags and padded dashboards and all that stuff. And we designed better roads, broader shoulders, more divided highways, better signage. And we've also got programs to try and improve the quality of the drivers, getting tougher on drunker drivers, graduated licenses, and so on. In other words, we nibbled at the problem. There wasn't some paradigm shift in traffic safety that took place, but rather we came at this from a lot of different directions, and that's how you get progress. And when we try and sell progress in terms of one wonder-working solution, one dramatic breakthrough. I mean, it does happen. Polio shots, you know, were a dramatic breakthrough. But by and large, that isn't how progress occurs.
It's at the margins.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Sociologist Joel Best is our guest this afternoon here on the program. His latest book, Flavor of the Month, Why Smart People Fall for Fads. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Something that I would like you to talk about a bit is, in the book you say it's a mistake to characterize institutional fads as irrational.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, I think people always think what they're doing makes sense. I think that part of what happens with fads is we dismiss them as little momentary episodes of insanity. And it's particularly easy to do that if we look back on something like the hula hoops and we say, well, that was silly. Why would anybody have done that? That's just crazy. But, you know, people don't implement a new management strategy for a corporation, which can come at a cost of millions of dollars in a particular company. They don't do that because they're acting irrationally. They do it because they think this is the way to higher profits. This is the route to success. And now, oftentimes, there's an emotional quality to this. That is, there is a certain excitement. There's pride in feeling that you're getting in on the ground floor. There's fear that you don't want to be left behind if everybody else adopts it and you don't. I mean, it's not a dispassionate process, but it isn't crazy. People are doing what they think is the right thing to do.
Yeah, everybody's doing the twist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonder what happened to all those hula hoops.
Well, ours gathered dust in the garage, I remember, and eventually became truly filthy and were thrown out.
Yeah, yeah. Went the way of Chicken a la King.
Yeah. Yes.
Calvin Trillin does a wonderful, he's got a wonderful essay in one of his books about Chicken a la King, whatever happened to it. It's in storage somewhere, he's certain of it.
Well, and that's, you know, that's very interesting because if you, you know, I've heard shows on NPR programs where they, you know, they have some cookbook author who's reviewing food dishes through the ages, and certainly I'm old enough to remember things that were very fashionable that have now faded away, and in the meantime, why we have whole new discoveries that are much more popular, and things that you know you may not have heard about, you know, 3 or 4 years ago are now all the rage. So yeah, absolutely. Eating is very faddish.
Well, I think Chicken a la King could come back as a comfort food. I don't know. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Good afternoon, Joel Best. I'll do my best not to make this a crank call, but do you know the statistics on the number of highway fatalities caused by drunk drivers versus cell phone users? And this begs a lot of other questions, of course. Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Where are the mothers against cell phone users? I'll hang up and let you go. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Okay.
I don't know what the statistics are for that, and I don't doubt for a minute that eating on the, talking on the cell phone gets people into a certain amount of trouble, and I'm ashamed to say that I was driving on the highway last night and loaded a CD and thought I'm trying to kill myself in the process. So there are obviously all sorts of behavioral things, and it seems to me that I was thinking that as we add more and more displays and things to read and fidget with on the dashboard, you probably are running some risk. But and the real point of that call, it seems to me, is that some issues rise to visibility, and partly it's a matter of packaging. Mothers Against Drunk Driving was a triumph of social movement organizing, and partly it was the idea that at least originally the members had lost children due to drunk drivers, and it focused attention on an issue that had obviously been around for a long time but been ignored. And I think that, there are all sorts of opportunities to organize campaigns just like that with cell phones or anything else.
Yeah. This is something that you also write about in Flavor of the Month, is that a problem needs to be identified and packaged.
Yeah. 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 And it, if you think about it, there are, any of us find ourselves on the receiving end of so many messages from so many different media, so that we're seeing things in the newspaper and in magazines, and we're listening on radio and watching TV and logging onto the internet and email and just conversations with people we know, and there is a tremendous clamor for our attention, and I think that means that there's kind of competition, and some claims are going to get noticed and some are going to get ignored. And partly it's a question of how well you package it. Do you have a snappy slogan? Is the book nicely designed? And a lot of, if you look at it, for example, the literature on management fads, the business bestsellers that come along, oftentimes they've got very cleverly designed hooks and very clever marketing campaigns and so on attached to them.
Yeah. Speaking of media, you note that at certain times of the year, the media will take a crack at trying to identify what's up and coming, the next hot toy, the next movie blockbuster.
Yeah.
A couple of questions here. Why is it difficult to predict the next big thing? And why do some things catch fire while others don't, despite the slogan, despite the best efforts of everybody involved?
Well, I think that partly you can fail to catch fire because the competition is too good. Take kind of a crass and dramatic overblown example. If you were organizing a social movement and you had your big demonstration scheduled for September 12, 2001, nobody was going to listen. There are sometimes other messages just overpower whatever it is you're trying to do. So and a lot of times people have to work at this. They have to experiment and see what works and revise and bring things back. But it certainly is the case that people can't predict. And an example that I have in the book is a reminder about Waterworld and Titanic, which were two ocean epics that came out in the middle 1990s. And I don't know if people remember this now, but Waterworld was a Kevin Costner adventure, and at the time, I think it was the most expensive movie ever made. And it was hyped. This was going to be huge, 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 and Kevin Costner was coming off his success with Dances with Wolves, and this could not possibly fail. And in fact, it was very disappointing. And what was really remarkable was that Titanic, which I think came out the following year, was expected to do very badly. It too had been a very expensive movie, and people thought that the producers had been very foolish to make it, because they said people will not go to a movie that they know is going to have an unhappy ending. They know the ship's going to sink, and you can't make this a story that people will want to go see. And in fact, that movie was supposed to be released in the summer, and it was postponed till Christmas, and people took that as a sure sign that it was a turkey. And of course, Titanic, you know, sailed on to box office records, and Waterworld sort of sank beneath the surface. And, you know, these are huge, hundreds of millions of dollars investments, which certainly had the best marketing energy of the studios behind them. And you had lots of people paying attention and predicting what was going to happen. And all the experts guessed very badly.
Yeah. You've included in your book humorous responses.
Yeah.
That of people who run up against novelties and they're like, you know, it's like you can see somebody putting together one of these kinds of responses, and you know, just saying, you know, and this is after they've rolled their eyes in private, you know, after being told, well, here's what, you know,
right,
here's what we're going to do tomorrow. And it's like, yeah. Do you have a favorite? There are so many.
Well, my favorite is actually one that I used to have posted over my desk for a long time. This is, folklorists call this office folklore, photocopy lore. You know, they're the little slogans and cartoons and fake memos that people put on their door or on their bulletin board or attached to their desk or so on. And the one that I really like, because it really captures the theme of the book in some ways, is one that's been around for decades. It's called The Six Stages of a Project. And the six stages are wild enthusiasm, disillusionment, total confusion, search for the guilty, persecution of the innocent, and praise and honor for the non-participants. And I can remember, you know, when I first posted that, it was sort of an expression that, you know, I'd been around the block, I'd seen it all, I wasn't going to get fooled again, and I thought it was very funny. And you can find that floating around the internet in many different versions.
In your field, you've seen a lot of flavors of the month.
Oh, sure. Sure, yeah. And any academic has.
Yeah.
Things come and go. The earlier caller mentioned small group research, which was a very big thing when I was a student. And another topic that became very prominent in sociology was the study of deviant behavior, and that has I think lost a lot of its momentum. On the other hand, a couple that have taken off, and you can sort of see why. One are studies of gender. And another is studies of social movements. Social movements were pretty disreputable up through about 1965. And then after the civil rights movement came along, sociologists began to think that they needed to write more appreciatively about social movements, and they began to put more energy into thinking about them. And that's been a big topic in recent decades.
Yeah. Have there been fads that shouldn't have faded, shouldn't have been fads, that could have been innovations?
Well, I think that most of institutional fads actually have loyalists. It isn't that everybody drops them. There are often people who say, you know, if only we'd really backed this, if only people had given it a chance, if only they'd put enough money behind it, this really could have worked. And I think you can probably point to almost any long gone enthusiasm, and you'll find folks out there who think, you know, we should have hung on to this. In fact, there's a guy, a sociologist who studied the physicists who continue to cling to cold fusion. There aren't very many of them, and they've changed the name of what they study, and I've forgotten what the new name is, but. You know, there are people out there that are still sort of mining that vein.
Hmm. When do these questions get asked, or are these questions asked? Are they asked? When are they asked? Does it work? Is it effective?
Well, I think that initially, in the early stages, it gets asked and answered in the most cursory way. That is, you say, this school in California has had a lot of success with uniforms. We need uniforms. And it's not that nobody asks the question. It's that they aren't demanding much in the way of evidence. And I think that the real problem is not at the start. It's after a while goes by, and there ought to be a lot of evidence available, people may still be riding on that anecdote. They may not have any evidence. And I think that oftentimes they abandon the fad without much evidence that it doesn't work. I mean, they probably haven't seen any breathtaking improvements. But typically it takes a long time to do the research. It takes some years. And I think they tend to get bored and turn their attention to something else more than they prove that something failed.
Mm. I think so often this gets back to the gap between perfection and what we have at the moment. I think that there's a feeling often, why not give it a try?
Sure.
But, you know, how do we keep in mind that we could be harming ourselves at the same time?
Well, I think that the sensible way to do this is to implement these things gradually and, look for evidence that it's working before, you know, spreading it. But I think that the fear is always that we don't want to be left behind. What if all our competitors do this and their profits start to go up and ours stay the same? And so instead of giving it a chance, instead of finding out how well it works, we do it all at once. People have written about prison systems in a state with lots of institutions, such as Illinois. There's a strong tendency when a new idea comes down the pike to decide, well, let's introduce this at all the state's prisons right now. And it might make a lot more sense to try instituting it at one institution and watch and see what happens and learn from that experience rather than do a sort of one-size-fits-all, let's transform the system instantaneously. But, of course, it isn't as exciting. It makes a better news story. It makes a better press conference if you announce that we're going to do it all at once everywhere.
Hmm. Who are likely to be resistors? Who are likely to be adopters?
Well, there's an interesting sort of literature about this. In the diffusion literature, there's an underlying assumption that new ideas are good ideas, and so they tend to talk about early adopters who are characterized as visionary and bold and heroic figures, and then they actually use the term laggards for the people who get on board late because they're seen as sort of slow and not with it and dumb, and it's an interesting sort of morality play. I think that in general what you find is that people who jump on bandwagons early tend to be better connected, so they're more likely to know about what's out there. They tend to be a little richer so that they can afford to invest in new ideas and maybe afford to take more chances. But you really have to, if you try and explain, well, which school systems adopt, this new method of teaching math or something, I don't think that we have a good answer for that.
Yeah. It's interesting. There was an article some time back in the New Yorker. This was quite a while ago, and I happened to know about this article because it showed up on a speak about, you know, something that's gone the way of the pocket watch, cassette tapes, cool hunters.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Shoe manufacturer.
Right. Malcolm Gladwell, yeah.
Takes a couple of savvy young people, You know, whether they've been trained in marketing or not, I don't know. And then they go out and they talk to kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they try and, based on that, they try and predict, you know, what shoe they should come out with or shoes.
Right. Yeah, there used to be a vision that we all occupied a place on one big status ladder. And the oldest theory of fashion and fads is that the people at the top would introduce something, whatever it is, a new tie or a new hat or something, and the people the next level down would want to seem like the folks above them, so they'd adopt it, and you know it would just trickle down this ladder. And of course, as it started going down, the people on the top would feel that this was no longer the distinctive thing that it once had been, because the great unwashed were starting to share this symbol, so they'd adopt something new. But in contemporary society, it's harder to see that happening. You know, I think there are lots, instead of one big status ladder, there are lots and lots of overlapping circles. And you have lots of examples of, you know, things that start among youth cultures or in ethnic cultures that then spread more widely to the larger population. And you can think about, you know, lots and lots of examples of this, blue jeans or something, which,
sure,
you know,
everybody wears them now.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They started, though. I mean, well,
yeah,
they were sturdy work clothes a long time ago, and then
exactly.
They were adopted by young people in the
right.
60s, and then pretty soon, you know, grandma and grandpa wear blue jeans.
That's right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Everybody's wearing them. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello. I tuned in late, but maybe you've covered this or it's in your book. What about the changing fads and fashions in psychiatric diagnoses and in counseling? A few years back, almost every woman who saw a psychiatrist or counselor was diagnosed as having been a victim of childhood sexual abuse. And that fad has died out because of a lot of lawsuits and so on. But what do you think about that?
Well, I think that psychiatry has been, you know, traditionally been particularly prone to diagnostic enthusiasms. The idea that you could recover memories of past abuse, and that all sorts of fairly ordinary problems, maybe being overweight or being unhappy or whatever, were probably rooted in abuse. That's an idea that has really dropped out. I think that what you have there is a sort of a measure of the sophistication of medical knowledge and medical science. I don't know that fads are anything like that apparent in I don't know if you go in with chest pains or something to a cardiologist. I think cardiologists probably have a pretty good handle on how things work. With psychiatry, people come in with more ambiguous symptoms. I'm not happy. I feel tired. Things of that sort. And for example, there have been people have written about a whole history of diagnoses for kind of general tiredness. Most recently, we tend to talk about this in terms of chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, but there are diagnoses for the same thing that go back quite some time, and different theories about what causes this and so on and so forth. Where there's a lot of ambiguity, you have a lot of opportunity for fads.
Yeah. We've got to wrap up now. We're closing in the last little bit here that we have time to spend together today. Talk with us very quickly about fad proofing.
Well, I think there are two lessons with fad proofing. The first is be aware that fads exist. I think that a lot of the trouble we get into is we aren't willing to call a fad, and as a result, we tend to ignore the fact that these are a ubiquitous part of our world. And the second lesson is demand evidence. And the longer the fad's been around, the more evidence you have a right to insist on seeing. And if you do those things, you can become resistant to fads, particularly the wasteful fads that can really do damage.
Mm. Joel Best, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Joel Best is a sociologist. He's a professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware. His latest book is Flavor of the Month, Why Smart People Fall for Fads, the book published by the University of California Press.
And that was an archive show from May of this year. It's 1:51, and we have our settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade here to do that. AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much. And taking a look at those numbers from the Board of Trade, futures finished in the wheat pits a bit lower today, led down by the spring wheat, off 14.75 cents in the December contract there, down 17.5 in Minneapolis in the nearby contract, a 4.68.5 settlement price for the Septembers in Minneapolis. A quick look at Kansas City, September wheat off 10.75, 4.82 the settlement price, December at 4.97, down 8.5 cents. Now the one we're most concerned with, soft red winter wheat traded in Chicago, September futures down a nickel today, 397.5 the high, the low at 391.75, their settlement price at 392.5, they were off a nickel, and the December futures a 411.5 high, rather 417 high, the low at 11.5, a settlement price at 413.25, they were down 3.25 for the day. March wheat futures 433 the high, the low at 29, settlement price at 431.25, off 5 cents, and the May contract down 5 as well. 442 the high, the low at $4.39. Settlement price off a nickel at $4.40 a bushel in the May wheat for next year. July contract next year, this is a harvest month for 2007. $4.48 a bushel on the high, the low at $4.43, and their settlement price at $4.44 even, off 6 cents for the day. Corn futures now in Chicago, September contract, $2.42 the high, the low at 237.25, settlement price at $2.40.5, they were up a penny and a half today. December futures rallying as well, 259 the high, the low at 54, settlement price at 57.75, that's $2.57.75, a penny and 3/4 higher for the December corn futures today. March contract at 272.75 high, low at 268. Settled at 271.25. They were up a penny and a half on the day. And the May futures, 281.75 the high. Low at 277.5. A settlement price at 281.25. Up 2 cents for the day. July futures, 291.25 the high. The low at 86. July next year, a 289.75 settlement price. Up a penny and 3/4. In September futures, 298 the high. The low at 93. Settlement price at 98. Up 2.5 cents for September 2007. Now the DEES contract, a year and a half out. 308.75 the high. Low at 302.5. Settlement price at 306.5. Up 2.5 for the day. And the March contract at 317 high, low at 312. Settlement price for the March 2008.